The Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia is proud to welcome you to a rotunda lecture by Chief Orrin Lyons on the origins of the principles of democratic governance. We begin at the beginning this semester. This is the first of the Miller Center lectures, and it's quite appropriate that a Native American should make the opening lecture. Arnold Toynbee has said that possibly the hope of the survival of the West and of the United States could rest with some of the culture and values of Native Americans and other minorities. Apparently the National Geographic thought so, because in the September issue, current issue, an article by Harvey Arden, "The Fire That Never Dies," portrays some of this tradition and culture. And in reporting one of the episodes, namely the discussion with the Sandinistas of the Onondaga and Chief Lyons and his colleagues, who were part of the Six Nation delegates discussing the future of the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua, Harvey Adams writes, "I heard Chief Lyons gently expounding to one increasingly wide-eyed Sandinista, quote, 'You guys should understand the Mosquito aren't alone in this. However you decide to treat them, remember, you're being watched by all Native American peoples, and there are 10 million of us. We won't forget what you do here.'" And then later, "We are the Haudenosaunee," Chief Lyons began, his words slow and measured, as though the angry words of a moment before, words of Russell Means, spokesman for the American Indian Movement, had never been spoken. "We are made up of six nations, each of us equal, each of us sovereign, and we come together in a confederacy. Our business is peace, not war." Voice unwavering, he told of the confederacy's origins and government. He explained how decisions must be reached by consensus, how no problem was important enough to cause disunity. "We must be of one mind," he said, echoing the peacemaker's ancient word. The author writes, "Later I told him, Orrin, you'd make a hell of a Secretary of State." I think we're pleased to have such a person with us this afternoon. He's engaged in a whole series of things as an Onondaga Iroquois chief, the publication of a major volume on the transference of democratic values, the launching of a newspaper with the help, I think one can say, with Tim Colley present, of the Worrell Enterprises, and a whole series of lectures, travel. If you see an airplane taking off in the near future, the chances are that it isn't Father Hesburgh, who was the most traveled educator until recently, but it's Chief Orrin Lyons. We're pleased to have him with us today.
Thank you very much for being here and being in good health. I want to greet each and every one of you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. I'm going to maybe make a reference to the last remark there. For people who are supposed to have their feet on the ground, I'm in the air quite a bit. And it's for a variety of reasons that fundamentally for the survival of our people and our principles and so forth. I want to acknowledge in the beginning here the strong support of Worrell Enterprises and many of our efforts, newly begun or old in nature, but newly supported. And It's this kind of coalition, I think, that's going to help expand some ideas that may not be readily available to you or have not been available to you over your lifetimes and to your children. And so, in the discussion that I had with some of the chiefs back home about this particular event, I said, well, how far shall I go? And they said, well, you've been in the field long enough to know. Just use your judgment, as you always have. And the idea here is to transfer some of our ideas and some of our thoughts, perspectives to you for your inspection and consideration, to inform you a little bit about the people who originate on this land and who still are here. We're going to talk about the Haudenosaunee, who the French call Iroquois and who the English called Five Nations and later the Six Nations. Proper name, Haudenosaunee, means people of the Longhouse. One of the things that is important in our survival has been the strong symbols that were given to us early on. Symbols that we carry, symbols that we can remember, symbols that our children use, symbols that everyone uses today within our territories and even outside. The symbol, the principal symbol we're going to talk about today is the Great Tree of Peace. Now this symbol, more than just that, reflects a people's vision to make a government based on the principle of peace. And to think in those terms, the vision of the future, and what is it that we are going to leave for our seventh generation. And so, prior to the event, Christopher Columbus making a landfall in the Western Hemisphere. Prior to that, we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the people that were here and what they thought and how they chose to live. This is a perspective of the Haudenosaunee. This is not a perspective of the great Lakota Nation, nor the Zunis, nor the Navajos. It is our story. And that's only the ones who I can speak for. And so, what I'm going to tell you a little bit about is our history and how it is that in September 3rd, 1987, a Haudenosaunee chief is addressing you. A continuance of a democratic government over at least 1,000 years. We're still here. We're still conducting our business. We still maintain those principles. And in that latter history, the last 3 days, so to speak, we had interaction with your people. In the spectrum of time, which you must take into consideration, when you discuss Indian people, Indian nations, we think in long terms. We take into consideration the time as it relates to the mountains. We take into consideration the time as it relates to the ant. And for the human being, we fall somewhere in between the ant and the mountain in our time. The time that we have to walk about on this earth is a very long time in the span of the ant. And it's a mere second in the span of the mountain. But for us, it is all we have for this time. So keep that as a reference, the time that you have to walk about on this earth. As we say, those days are numbered, and we don't know what that number is for each of us, but there certainly is a number of those days. So, as we're told, then you must be prepared, because it could be today. There is no guarantee that when you get up in the morning, you're going to lay down at night in your bed. There is no guarantee. That is the reality. And so, you should be ready, as they say, to step across that line. A long time ago, and we really don't know how long, the history of the Haudenosaunee is made up in primarily three segments. We are now living in the last segment. The first one, called the first message, occurred beyond our memory, only that we knew it occurred. And we know what was said. But what time it occurred, we have no idea. Early in life on this planet. At that time, people were living much the same way that the animals were. And we received the first message, and the message was how you will live, how you will conduct yourself. And so there is a long story about that. Because, of course, what is involved in there is your life, your lifestyle, the principles that you will adhere to while you're walking about on this earth. So the message of how you will live was passed on to our people, and they live that way. And in this land that you're able to see yet today, here and there, these flashes of what beauty and tranquility there was here at one time, when all the waters were crystal clear and you could drink from any river or any stream or any lake or any spring. There was that time here when these rivers and lakes were teeming with life. Abundance. When you could look about and the trees, the grandfathers, were even then 6 feet through. A maple 120 feet high. And by the thousands they were. That was here. Where? Passenger pigeons, by the millions and millions, existed, and people to eat merely had to pluck one, literally off a tree. And the buffalo, all the way to the coast. This was a land of abundance, a land of peace. And in these lands, there were people. And these people were in every corner of this land. And you can find the evidence. And so our history tells us that we came from the West. And we have the names for the great rivers and lakes. A long time ago. So at that time, this was a land of great peace. with people who live by the instructions, where old people were easily over 100 years. Now everyone was healthy. And there was time. There was time to discuss ideas. And so what we're going to talk about is the ideas that we built a house on. This house is like an idea. And so our house was the longhouse with the rafters of our Constitution, with the smoke holes of our nation, with the one family, one idea. And so upon our land and upon our people came a falling out with these principles. And as human beings are prone to do, to forget what are these laws of rights and how to live. And so our lands became engulfed in wars, and our people fought amongst each other, nation against nation, family against family, brother against brother. It was a vicious war of attrition. All the leaders were the most strongest and powerful and the fiercest. And there was devastation. And the people lived in fear and neglect. And it was this time that the second message came. The second message began with the birth of a boy north and west of what we call Lake Ontario. The mother of this boy, upon interrogation by the grandmother, could not name the father. And it embarrassed and shamed the grandmother. And she tried to destroy this child. But this is a long story that I'm not going to get into today. But it has its own dimensions. Suffice to say that this grandmother was told that this boy must be protected and must be cherished because he has a mission. And so that's the way he grew up. And prepared himself at all times for this mission. And there came a time when he said, "It is time for me to leave." And he fashioned a great stone canoe that was white. And these people said, "It will never float." He continued his work, and at this time he said farewell. And he left instructions of how to check on his welfare while he was gone, and also instructions to finally meet him or regain his help at some time. And he left. In his white canoe, he landed on the southeast shore of Lake Ontario and walked into this great strife that was occurring, these fierce battles that were going on. He said, the first person he met, "I'll come on a mission to bring peace." And he was warned that this was a very poor time and a very poor place to be. But they said, "There is a man who lives in the woods, an exile from Onondaga, who speaks much the way you do. Perhaps you should find him." And so he did. Seeked him out. The man's name was Hayanwentup. And he was an Onondaga who had exiled himself because he suffered this great tragedy of having seven of his daughters killed by the Tododaho, who was a very evil and powerful leader of the Onondagas. And he was by himself in the woods. And so they had a discussion. And again, that is a very long story. And it has its own dimensions, which we won't get into. But again, suffice to say, they met. And he enlisted his help. He said, "You speak very well. Come with me and let's see if we can bring peace." And so they went, group by group. They went to the fiercest of leaders and they persuaded this person to change his direction. And they went, they worked their way through the Mohawk territories. And with the help of these now different thinking men, they went to the Oneida Nation in the south, and the same thing occurred. And then again they went to the Onondagas, central. They had to go around the Tododaho. He would not submit, he would not speak. He merely receded into the woods anytime they came. So they went on to the Cayugas. And then they went on to the Senecas. Together they came back and they met this Seneca woman at a village somewhere middle south of Lake Ontario. In this village, they talked to this woman and she said, "You're going to need a lot of help to meet the Tododaho. He's a powerful, powerful individual. For your message of peace." And so she helped him in how he should devise this. And they came back then, all of them. And some say that this process took 100 years. And some say it took less. But we don't know. We know it took a long time. But eventually they came to the Tododaho, and with the help of a song, with the help of a bird who gave them a song, they could approach the Tododaho, who was so fierce, they said, that snakes were entwined in his hair. And he was an evil man. And he looked terrible. And as they approached him, they said even the song was dropping the snakes from his hair and he began to transform. And so the discussion went, finally, that if the Tododaho and the Onondaga Nation would consent to this union of peace, then the Onondaga Nation would be a central fire, would have a spiritual work, would be responsible for that center force, and that the Tododaho would become responsible for the spiritual welfare and health of the people. And this is the way it would be. And so it was agreed. And then on the eastern shore of Onondaga Lake, which is near Syracuse, New York at this point, the great meeting was finally held. When all the chiefs had gathered, these men that he had put up, and he raised them, and he gave them the process of governance. In this one meeting, he raised the chiefs, he raised the clan mothers, he raised the faith keepers, and he gave the duties, and he gave the process of government. How you would sit, what are the songs, how you will discuss, what are the rules. And he placed in the hands of the women the nations. And he says, from now It will be the women who carry the heritage of the nation. They will be responsible. Because like the Earth Mother, they are responsible for life. And so it was, the heritage became matrilineal. That was rule or law one. And he said that it will be up to the women to reach out and bring the spirit of the herb choice into the nation to build strong people. He said, this, the most cherished principle of life, is peace. He says, peace begets freedom. Freedom is responsibility. He said, all of the laws that we are putting down today will adhere to the principal spiritual great law, the natural law. He said, you must understand that there are rules and there are laws to life that we are all bound to. And so your rules and your governance must be consistent with that natural law. These natural laws that bind all life together. Law number one is water. Without water, no life exists. All life exists with water. He said, water is life. You must respect and give thanks. The way you'll do that, he said, is ceremonies to the great thundering grandfathers who bring fresh rain and they water the earth and they water the people and they water the trees. That will be your ceremony. Respect them. And they will continue to do their duty as long as you respect them. These thundering grandfathers that you hear. He said, in the springtime, when you hear the first voice of the thundering grandfather, says, immediately rush about and give thanks. They have returned again this year to continue their duty. And on he went to many, many things about what we are bound to in life. Common law to all life. He said, all life is equal. You are neither more nor less. You must respect all life. It is intertwined, all life. One supports the other. And so respect is important. And he says, I'll give you ceremonies so that you can carry out these thanksgivings and respects proper times and proper ways, in which he did. Then when he raised the chiefs and he said, you original chiefs, your name shall become an office. And when you pass on, then your clan mother will choose from her clan the next candidate to fill that office. It is the choice of the woman in getting leadership. The woman's choice is tempered for the family, compassion for life. She looks to that person who is fair, who is honest. This is her choice. Her choice is then given to the Klan to ratify. If they disagree, she must find someone they agree with. If they agree, then she takes the choice to the Klan mothers and says, come with me. We'll speak to the chiefs. We're ready with a candidate to replace the one we lost. And with that candidate is what we call a sub-chief. Two. And so, two men chosen. When she goes to the chiefs, she presents the name. And it's discussed among the chiefs, and they have the right to reject, because they know that this person has to sit with them now for the rest of his natural life. And can they work with him? And does he have the right mind for this particular job? Or maybe they can't see what the mother can see. And at some points, as I myself have sat, we give the judgment over to her choice and say, she sees something that we cannot, so let us abide by her decision. So, if that's agreeable, now we have a candidate to fill the seat. Now, runners are sent to the other house, because our house is two sides. Our younger brothers, the Cayugas, the Oneidas, and the Tuscaroras, receive the runner, and we tell them, we are ready to raise the chief. And they begin immediately. They deliberate, and they send a runner back to us and tell us, this will be the day, and this will be the place. And this is the speaker we have chosen to speak on that day, because your side, your house is in mourning from losing that chief. And so the great condolence is called, and then the runners from Onondaga are sent to all of our nations, carrying the sacred wampum invitation for the time and the day. And on that day, they gather as they have gathered since that beginning time. They come to the place, the chiefs and the people, to see who is it that they're raising. There's a rule to this, and the rule is that the person that is chosen by the clan mother, his name is never mentioned to the outside public, only the office. And so when people come, they come there for the first time to see who is it that's being presented. And the reason for this is to prevent sniping by people beforehand. So when the person is put in front of the Grand Council, the great condolence, he stands on his merit. His side of the house cannot project. They cannot speak. The speaker has been chosen from the other side. So there cannot be an emphasis on politics. And then he is judged by one house. And they have the right to dismiss him at that point. And if that occurs, generally it revolves around what it takes to not be a chief. One, you can never have killed anybody. No blood on your hands. Two, you can never have committed a crime against a woman or a child. Three, you must believe implicitly in the great law. You cannot be a Christian in these days. Of course, at that time, there were no Christians. There were only believers here. But those were the rules. Simple. And so then, after great wampums have been passed back and forth, which takes all day, after meeting at the edge of the woods, which takes great ceremony and song and words that are as ancient beyond people's remembrance, this occurs. And again we meet And then together, the great procession as they go into the longhouse to raise this chief. Then the roll call is called. They call the hi-hi. And back and forth, the man walks calling the roll of the original 50 chiefs. And it takes 2.5 hours to call that roll. He talks about them and what they said and what they did. And then the laws of condolence are passed over from the younger brothers. And the laws of conduct are repeated and passed to the elder brothers in strings of wampum. And that takes another 2.5 hours, depending on the speaker. And then the laws are reiterated and sent back across. And it takes the same length of time. So the people who are sitting there and who have sat through these condolences have heard the law again and again. These are the rules. These are your conduct. This is what the clan mothers will do. This is what the chiefs will do. This is what the sub-chief will do. This is how it is. When that's all done, then they say, now, bring forth your candidate to present to the people. And at this time, the clan mother will go, and this is what everybody is looking for. Who is it? And sometimes the most unlikely person that people would say. And he comes forward. It takes great courage at that point to come forward, because this is a commitment. This is not a 4-year term. This is a life commitment. And so, quite unsuspecting, in most cases, comes this man, usually of great innocence. And he's judged. Who is his family? Why did you choose him? Are you sure about his character? One, not. One house and then the other. If he passes that, good, they say. Now, does anyone here have a reason for this man to not be a chief? Do you know amongst the people here a reason why? Then now is your time to speak. If you know a reason why this man should not be a chief and you do not speak now, then you are bound never to bring it again. And so the last order is from the people. And that's where I've seen the chiefs knocked down. I've seen it. Terrible. It's a terrible forum. There was not a vote taken. There was no campaigns taken. We are raising leadership through a process, a democratic process that's almost absolute. And if this person survives all of that, they say, good. And then they take him to the middle. And the speaker grabs his head like this, like they did to me. Look at him. Remember him. This is your representative. Now that this is done, we will eat. And it is the men who have been cooking all day, not the women. They were getting the meat ready, and they were getting the bread ready. And they come in. And no utensils are used. You must eat with your hands, because today, on all days, we can't take the chance of even a pinprick. So you eat with your hands. And the first duty of this person is to take that meat and bread and serve the people. And he said, that's the way you're going to operate. And then he has given his duties. which nobody's prepared for. After they give all these severe duties, and they tell you that your first duty is to see that the ceremonies are carried out, because without the spiritual law and heart, you're not going to have a community or a nation. The second duty is to sit in council for the welfare of the people, to put your minds together, as the peacemaker said, and to become one heart, one body, one mind, in unity. And he said, after all these things, he said, this is upon your shoulders a mantle of tears. And your skin shall be 7 spans thick to withstand the arrows and slings that are going to come at you in your position. And you are not to respond. You are to always have compassion and no anger. You must yearn for the welfare of the people. And you must give your life to the people. This is what you have agreed to. And after all of this, he says one more thing. By the way, from what we understand and from what we're told, it is very unusual for a chief, a Hoyane, let's use the correct term, a Dianisun, the good minds, the peacemakers, that's what it means. It's very unusual, so we've heard, that you will ever see the face of the Creator. Because your job is so fraught with danger that you are going to fail. And if you fail, you will not see the face of the Creator. And what comes across your mind at that point is, how come nobody told me that before? Then they said, but on the other hand, you merely have to do what is right. And this, in a very short time, is a process of raising our leaders. It is a democratic process. By the way, they said, your clan mother has the power of recall. Your conduct will determine that. If the people feel and begin to complain about your conduct, then she will be forced to bring her daughter, which is to say a woman, with her and formally give you your first warning. Then explain to you what the people have been complaining about and demand that you rectify that. If their conduct continues, then she comes again with either the chief or the sub-chief, as the case may be, and gives you the second warning to rectify your behavior. If you fail again, then she comes with the man who has no mercy. And he is coming for your emblem, your symbols, symbol of your office, which is the deer antlers. And he is coming to take those antlers in this third warning. And only by the most extraordinary means and measures can you escape that. And so, if he takes them, he rips them from your head, and the blood flows down across your face so that no one recognizes you and no one hears you when you speak. We are told that you are a spiritual being, that we are spiritual. We are the manifestation of the creation. It's all that you can see is a manifestation of the creation. Therefore, you must respect it. Therefore, you must respect your brother and your sister, because they are a manifestation of the creation. Equal and equally responsible. The animals and the plant life, they live in a state of grace. They can't do anything wrong. They still sing their songs. They still grow their leaves. They still sprout their corn. They still grow their fur. And they do what they have to do in spite of us, those that have options. So again, we come to ourselves. Our conduct. Spiritual forces is both dark and light. They're both spiritual, and they're both powerful. And if I were to say that the arm wrestling, if we put this to a simile of an arm wrestling match, the spiritual forces of the light is somewhere down here. We're losing a battle for the future. We have to think in these contemporary times about the rainforests in Brazil. We have to think about the acid rain in the Black Forest and in Vermont. We have to think about the seals and the fish with DDT in the North Sea. We have to think about the uranium in the ground, about waste, about the future of your children. A little less for profit and a little bit more for life. The message of the Haudenosaunee, as the peacemaker said. Second message. We were given a third message, which again is a long story. People heard about him, this man. Gunyundayo, Handsome Lake, 1800, 1799, a chief, the Seneca Nation, a drunk, a despot, who changed, and eventually was given a vision. And in this vision, the third message, he was shown what is going to take place here. And on the 19th of this month, in September, in the longhouses of the Haudenosaunee, this message will be told again. 4 days of what is going to happen to this earth. The third message. Where are we in that particular litany? One of the things that he was shown, when the four protectors were taking him about, those four great beings that protect mankind, they said, "What do you see over there?" He says, "I see a great maple, and it's dying from the top. And I look about and I see that the maples are dying from the top." And they said, "Yes, that's the chief of the trees, the maple. And in some time in the future, you're going to see them dying from the top down. When that time comes, and take heed of your conduct." Last year, in Vermont, the maple tree growers of Vermont were complaining publicly They said, our trees are dying from the top down. The acid rain is ruining our business. Well, in 1800, there was no acid rain. We didn't know what he meant. But that was a public statement. The great maple is dying from the top down. That was just one of many revelations. But again, I say, it's a long story. And so, with us, being human beings, and having that power of individual beings, creativity, energy, direction, then we should begin to think about that seventh generation. When we talk about these democratic principles transferred to the founding fathers of America, this very place, beneficiary of that thought, beneficiary of that knowledge. And that again is another story. What I want to talk to you today about was those things that are not written, those things that we know, those things that are passed on to us each generation. And the oral tradition that we have, which prevails up to this time. Just an insight into the intensity of oral tradition. Because the elders at one time know that their days are numbered. The teachers say, it's late, and what haven't I taught? I must turn my attention to those who will learn. And so the elders turn their attention to the ones that are going to take up this responsibility. These people see the same event. My grandmother, my grandfather is leaving. Soon, I've got to find out more. And so there is an intense transference of knowledge at that time. And the grandfather will even reach further back into the littlest one. The older he becomes, the further he reaches. To tell him of even the most basic laws. You say, grandchild, don't lie. Grandchild, don't steal. You learn those two, and you have a great community. Two things. It's not too hard. In this day when I can pick up the Washington Post and the New York Times and talk about lying, you better look to your leaders. You better look to yourself. If you're going to sit and let your leaders determine the fate of your children. Nature of this discussion is the intensity of oral tradition. That's what you're feeling right now. That's the way I feel. Done it. I haven't got any questions.
I think you can handle your own questions. Chief Lyons, among other things, is an artist. He was an All-American lacrosse player. He has enormous energy, and so he's able to answer at least a few questions before we adjourn. Who'd like to ask the first question? Tim Collins.
Chief Lyons, is the role of women among the Six Nations of the Iroquois unique among Indian tribes?
No, I find it quite common. I think that the role of women I don't know how to quite to put this, except that when two or three women come to a meeting, all our attention is immediately on the women. And a lot of times they guide. They don't come out and tell you, but they nudge and they guide. And then I find that in the fights of survival that we had, that the women are in front. They are absolutely the ones out on the line, in front. Because, of course, they're protecting their nation, and also they're protecting their men. Because when the men get out on line, that's what we don't want to see. There's a different end to that discussion. A woman can say a lot of things that a man cannot to another man. They know these powers. So I would say that very great respect for female life and the powers they hold. As a matter of fact, the idea of rape was absolutely foreign. Or now we have deterioration in our societies the same way you have in yours. And sad to say, we're picking up a lot of bad habits. We're concerned. I'm concerned for my community. Our community is not a haven. It's not a great place. It's a tough place to live. Any place is tough today. We're just a little bit lucky that we have these kind of ideas and principles, and we can still leave our doors unlocked, and the women and children can walk about at all hours of the night, and they can be safe. But the edges are fraying pretty good. And I think that's the way it is all over. So great attention must be paid, you know, to the woman's role in this, and respect of that particular life. That's a good question.
Question over there. How is belief in God or the Great Spirit related to democratic practice?
Well, I would say that it's the central force. It's what we call the spiritual law. It's a center law. That's a spiritual law, and that our contemporary law just wind around that. As a matter of fact, they say as a chief that when your back gets weak as a human being, this is the law that will stiffen your back. So it's involved in our everyday life. It's the law, actually, spiritual law.
Yeah. Mr. Tarman.
What are some of the major problems faced by your constituents today? Some of the major things you
find. Bingo. Economic development. Having resources on your land that everybody wants. Trying to keep your children from committing suicide. Trying to bring some kind of form of education, availability with the proper modifications so that we are not totally obliterated by the ideas of the dominant society. That's very difficult. But education, health has become a major problem. Alcohol, well, that was a tool that Benjamin Franklin said was the only way you're going to get Indian land, with alcohol. And so we're suffering today that the results of it, it's almost a way of life in some areas. Very difficult, very hard circumstances for us. Maintaining our language, it's important. It was a federal policy to eliminate our language. That was the first thing they went after. So now this generation is beginning to suffer the results of that. It's a serious consideration of the elders and the people because, and this is important to remember as it relates to all nations around the world, the indigenous populations, that there are, within those languages, knowledge that's different than yours. And this knowledge may be the key for you, for people's survival. So there's keys in this language that's extremely important. And it's pretty hard now to rectify that, but that doesn't make you back off. You have to do it. So those are major problems. And I guess one more we can add to that is the urbanization of a lot of our people and the problems that happen internally, just the human problems that everybody has. Good things, some good things. In the year 1900, there were somewhat less than 250,000 Indians left in the whole continent. North. From, just by the best educated guess, anywhere from 16 million people, conservatively, say 14 even. So the question remains is, what happened to all those people? Almost extinct like the buffalo. Now 1.5 million. We're gaining back. But like all populations. Now, that brings together the other thing is that this relates to general population. And general population is displacement. When you have an enlargement of great populations, you're displacing trees, animals. So it's a serious problem that's coming that this very next generation is going to have to deal with directly. Within the next 25, 30 years, you're going to have a very serious problem in terms of that. So common problems, I guess, humanitarian problems, but for ourselves, maintaining our culture, keeping that integrity, that's very difficult.
Do you have a written code of law, and is there a formal process for amending it?
Well, what they said is that you can use your minds. If you had to add a rafter, the way they put it, then the rafter cannot violate any of the basic principles. You have the basic principles. No, we did not write this because we don't want it subject to interpretation. And that's exactly what would happen immediately. People would begin, well, this is what this means. When I said, you've been here, you know, our association for 3 days. That's a broad term. We use it like that. 3 days could be 3 days. It could mean 3 years. It could mean 300 years. And that's the way I was using it. So when you try to translate that, you're going to get into a hodgepodge. And purposely, we do not. We have been asked again and again to codify, and we refuse. We maintain ourselves that way. Yes, sir.
I wanted to, you mentioned Benjamin Franklin, and in the announcement it said something about the influence of the tribal forms on Benjamin Franklin, which he transmitted to our constitutional ideas. Is there anything?
Yeah, there's a lot of, well, yeah, I can comment on that. In, Some of the more better known instances, and there's a lot lesser, we have 8 scholars working on at this moment, a book which should be published sometime next spring on this transference of democratic ideals to the founding fathers. Probably one of the better known instances was in 1744, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, at a treaty meeting, when a chief, Onondaga chief, spoke to the gathered governors of the various colonies and told them that you should bind yourself together in a union such as ours for your welfare and for your happiness, and went on to give some instruction. The person that was taking notes at that time was Benjamin Franklin. He wrote that particular thing up, and then in 1754, when the Albany Congress came about, which was called by the King of England to find out how he could tax everybody over here, but which was not used that way, which was kind of a coalition movement by the colonies over here. Benjamin Franklin asked the Six Nations to come to that forum in Albany and to discuss government. And so they did. And the involvements, you know, continual involvements of all of this just went on and on. And the hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of meetings between the Six Nation chiefs and governors and colonies.
Where did that take place?
All up and down the East Coast, Many times they came to Indian country. That was a very powerful entity. One of the things you have to remember about those times was that in 1754, Chicago was a village with an Onondaga name on it. Dallas didn't exist. Comanches down there. L.A. wasn't there. Minneapolis wasn't there. You had a string of villages along the East Coast, and your western frontier is the Allegheny Mountains. That's what you have to remember about 1754. It's hard. The population you had here, very small. Population in the interior, very large. And a very old government sitting astride those ways out to the west. Well, that's a lot of interest, a lot of influence, and a lot of transactions.
Did I understand you say that a Christian cannot be propered by the land mother?
Right. The thinking on that is because there are two minds. His mind is split. His mind will have to think in the terms of his Christian beliefs and also the beliefs of the Haudenosaunee. So you can't have a man with a split mind. That's a bad policy.
What is the working relationship and the cultural relationship among the various Indian tribes, or nations, I should say, today?
They're banding together very, very, you know, we have a lot of interaction on a higher level. I mean, there are several levels of interaction. One is powwows, which is sort of a social interaction. Everybody goes from Oklahoma up to Montana to, you know, all over. And then there is, on the political spectrum, a very, very high level of interaction, both with even Central and South America, and also with the Samis in Norway, with the Aborigines in Australia, with Aboriginal people. We have a network. And all concerned about the same thing. Almost all have the same problem, you know. And so we have a pretty good network, and they even bought me a computer a couple of days ago. So.
one or two last questions.
Is your visits as nation-to-nation relationship with the central governments wherever you go, say Nicaragua or now Europe? What is your feeling of what they think when you come and talk to other people about the economy and nation?
Well, in Europe, we've traveled a lot lately, you know, in Europe in the past 10 years or so. 15 years, we've been over quite often. I just returned back from a session at the Working Group of Indigenous Populations in Geneva, Switzerland 3 weeks ago. They like Indians beyond almost, I mean, it's kind of difficult to explain. They idolize and romantic ideas about Indians and so forth, but they're very open. They very much want to know about it. They don't know very much about it. Governments have accepted our passport. The Haudenosaunee travels on an Iroquois passport. We've been in 24 countries with our passport. And it's always a curiosity, you know, and it's always of interest to them, but they take us quite seriously. And we've been able to talk with leaders in The Hague. It's amazing the availability of leadership in Europe. I'm always astounded by it, you know, because it's easy to talk to them and they are interested. On the other hand, we can come and knock on the door here in Washington for 3 weeks and never get in to see anybody. So it's kind of contradictory, isn't it? It's something I think that American public's got to look to and, you know, be aware of, because these principles here are important and they are common to all of us.
One final question I think you have.
I'd like to go back to the question on Christianity. Could you distinguish briefly what you see as the difference between Christian and your religion? And also mention if there are any books that well represent your religion?
Well, I'll answer the last question first. There's not really any books Again, we just have a penchant for not doing that, you know. The first question, what's the biggest distinction? Manifest destiny. It's a big distinction. It's not our distinction. Everybody knows what that means. We were subjects.
Maybe this is a sober note on which to end.